Okay. All right, great. So welcome back. We are going to jump into the demo that failed the first time because of my fault, not because of anything you did. So let's go ahead and set up Team Foundation Server. So once again, I'm going to have our brave volunteer come up and go ahead and get started here. All right. All right, we made it to the second page. Nice job.
I ran to read.
Oh, you're reading the license agreement. We don't have all day, man. So now you're figuring out which components you want to install. No problem. Yeah. Let's take them all. Yeah. Why not? We're feeling brave, right?
Yeah.
So one thing you may notice is that we're actually installing on top of Windows 7. And so what you can do with Team Foundation Server 2010 is you can now install into Windows 7 or Windows Vista if you want. The other thing that's really cool is that if you have Visual Studio 2010, any edition, Professional, Premium, Ultimate, if you have Visual Studio with an MSDN subscription, we give you your own server license to Team Foundation Server, and we give you the client license as well. So if you have, you know, one person or 10 people on your team, then that either gives you a server license or 10 server licenses. Everyone can set up their own, or you can set up a shared server for everyone to connect to. We basically, in this release, are trying to just, you know, give away Team Foundation Server because we think it's that important. So what we're doing in the first phase is we're going ahead and copying the installation bits onto our client. So this is a two-phase setup now. We haven't actually configured anything. The only thing I've done to this box in order to set it up is install SQL Server Express and install IIS. So now we can go ahead and click on Configure, and this will launch the second phase of Team Foundation setup. And so you have a number of different wizards in here. And so the basic wizard just gives you version control, work item tracking, and build capabilities. If we wanted to set up SharePoint or reporting services, we could do that, but we would require a server operating system for those. So let's go ahead and set up the basic. You'll notice we can also upgrade. So if you're upgrading from 2005 or 2008, it's really not a problem. It's asking you which version of SQL Server you want to use. With TFS Basic, all you need is SQL Server Express. This one's easy, there's only one option. Yeah. Yep. Yep. And so in this phase, what we're doing is we're actually verifying that you have all the prerequisites set up. For those of you that set up TFS 2005 and 2008, you might get 30 minutes from the installation and then it tells you you have a problem. So we're doing a lot to make sure we check this up front and then go ahead and configure. And now this is actually going to do the work of setting up TFS. So in about 5 minutes here, we'll have TFS all set up and configured. So thank you very much for doing the setup now. You can add this to your resume. Yeah, and we'll check in with this later just to make sure everything went okay. So at the end of the last presentation, I was going to talk a little bit about some of the build capabilities we have in 2010, as well as IntelliTrace, which is another capability as well. And so I'm just going to wrap up those capabilities before we jump into the rest of the day, which is about software testing. And so if you're familiar with TFS, then you know that it already has a build capability built in. So you can set up an automated build server by coming into the builds node and setting up a new build definition. And so, you know, here I have my build definition for my project. And in 2008, we gave you a lot of flexibility for when you build. So in 2005, all we did is we said, okay, you can either kick off a build manually or you can kick off a build on a scheduled basis. So, you know, every night at 10 o'clock, we want to build our software. But if you're familiar with the concept of continuous integration says we should build early and build often. And so I'm going to continue to pick on Clemens over here. Of course, he has the microphone next, so I have to be careful. But let's say that, you know, Clemens makes some changes, and he checks those into Team Foundation Server, and then he goes to lunch. And the build server goes out, and it runs, and it comes back, and it says, hey, you know, you forgot to check in a file. Or, you know, you're building on your 32-bit machine, and in fact, we need to make sure this compiles and runs on 64-bit. So one of the 64-bit unit tests actually fails. You know, any number of things that might fail. And so with continuous integration, we can enable that so that it automatically builds all of Clemens' code and tells us whether or not something failed. But the problem is, 10 minutes later, we find out that it failed, and he just went to lunch. And oh, by the way, within those 10 minutes, you know, three more people actually got those changes, and so now they've got these broken changes within their own projects. And you know, we're all going to be pretty angry at Clements when he gets back from lunch, and so we don't want that to happen. And so this problem happens all the time at Microsoft, especially. Even though we have some very talented developers, we have some very large teams. And so you can imagine a scenario where you have 30 developers on a team, and each developer only breaks the build, let's say, once per month. You know, I know no one in this room, right? But you can probably think of that guy that breaks the build once per month, right? So once per month is really not a lot for a developer. And so the problem with that, though, is we have 30 people breaking the build once per month. Your build's probably going to be broken every single day. And so this is a problem. What we've done in order to solve that problem at Microsoft is we've implemented a system called Gauntlet. With Gauntlet, what we do is we say, before we check your changes into Team Foundation Server, we want to make sure that we build those changes, so the source code compiles, and then we want to make sure we run a number of build verification tests as well. So maybe those are unit tests or other things that we can do to make sure that you didn't actually break the build. And so we've enabled the Gauntlet style of build within Team Foundation Server now as a feature called gated check-in. And to turn on gated check-in, all you have to do is check this radio box for gated check-in. And now anytime I check in changes, prior to actually committing those changes, we're going to build those first, run any of the unit tests or any other automated tests, and make sure that those pass prior to accepting those changes. So if I come into my source control now, I've turned on gated check-in. Let's go ahead and make a change back to my production branch again. Let's uncomment some of those changes that we made earlier. We're just undoing this change. Whoops. Save that. Gated check-in. So now when we click on check-in, it's going to give us a new dialog telling us that rather than actually committing your changes right away, we're going to validate these changes. And so this is the gated check-in dialog. And so this is telling the developer, we're not going to make your changes available right away. We're going to build them, and then if they pass, then we're going to commit them. Now, in this case, you know, I made a change to the production website. I'm a lead developer. I know what I'm doing. Maybe, you know, this is a change that's really critical that it goes out right away. Can we actually fast-track that change? And so the answer is yes, we can. And so as long as I have permissions, I can actually bypass that validation, and it's going to go straight back into the source control repository. But let's say that I didn't want to bypass those changes. I could go ahead and click on build. I won't do it in the interest of time, but basically it would build those changes, and then when it was done, it would give me a dialog saying whether or not my changes were committed, or if they did not pass, whether or not those changes were rejected. So that's gated check-in. Also remember that you can use gated check-in or really any build capability in combination with that layer diagram validation. So we want to make sure that the changes Clemens modeled in our layer diagram are actually preserved throughout the source control. And so we can do that by enforcing layer diagram validation at the point of build or at the point of check-in. I'll just undo those changes. Get back to my original project. And just check out on our install. Looks like TFS Basic got all set up. So, you know, really, no barriers to entry for Team Foundation Server development anymore. If you want to set up Team Foundation Server, you could go home and set it up tonight. Hopefully, you have better things to do on your Friday night. But if not, we want to make sure that you can do that. Bear with me 1 second while I find my other slides. Talk amongst yourselves. I know they're in here somewhere. I've been on the road for 3 weeks, so things are starting to run together. Okay. I don't want that. Okay. Has anybody seen these before? Choose your own adventure. Anybody?
No, I'm the only one? All right, one guy is admitting. Thank you very much. So, you know, these are books that I used to read when I was a kid. They're called Choose Your Own Adventure books. I know a lot more people have actually heard of them, and you're just not willing to admit it in front of your peers. That's okay, not a problem. So let's pretend that nobody knows what a Choose Your Own Adventure book is. The idea with a Choose Your Own Adventure book is that as you're reading them, they give you a set of options. And so, for example, on this particular page, I'm in a submarine. I'm paraphrasing here, but I'm in a submarine, and I'm at the bottom of the ocean floor, and I run across a great white shark. And I have a couple of options. It says, you know, if you decide to fire the special propulsion charge to get to the surface, turn to page 20, so we can go up very quickly to get to the surface and get away from the shark. Or we can decide to turn to page 22 and wait around and hope that the shark goes away. So any preference? Who wants the shark? Who wants to wait around and see if the shark goes away? Okay, and who wants to go to the surface? Okay, so I think we're waiting around. Most people want us to wait around and hope that the shark goes away. So we turn to page 22, and it says, you wait for the shark to go away. No luck. Other sharks are coming to join the hunt. Yada, yada, yada. You end up dying down this path. So, you know, that's not good. But notice what I did is I kept my thumb in the page. So I kept my thumb in the page so I can go back to where I made the decision. And so, you know, actually, I you guys are all wrong. I don't want to go to page 22. Instead, I actually want to go to page 20 and blast up to the surface. And so, you know, you fire the special propulsion charge, and it takes you up to the surface, and you go up and up and up, and you get really dizzy, and you pass out, and you die. So, you know, these are the books I read as a kid. My life was depressing. And in fact, you know, it seemed when I was a kid like I was dying all the time. I was always having to go back. And so, in fact, I found a guy that actually modeled all the different scenarios that can happen. And so this is this particular book. And you can see anything that's red is an unfavorable death. I don't know what a favorable death is, but that's an unfavorable death. And then anything that's orange is like really, really bad still. You didn't quite die. And yellow is like, you know, still not a great day. And so there's only a few options that actually result in a really happy ending. And as it turns out, you know, over 80% of the time, you'll actually die or like, you know, have some serious bodily harm happen to you. So, you know, these are the books that we read as kids. It's not a good thing, right? But there's a great analogy to be made here for software, because a lot of the times, you know, we take a look at a situation and we find a bug, and we know that we just had an, you know, unfavorable death within our software, right? And so what we want to know, though, is not just, you know, is our software failing, because we know that that happens a lot, but how did we get here? How do we make sure that this doesn't happen again? And so wouldn't it be nice if we could do the same thing? We keep our thumb in the page, and we go back, and we go back, and we go back, and we say, okay, I see this problem happened because, you know, this is the change we made to this variable, or we called into this file, or we didn't have access, or something along those lines. And so if you think about the way that you might solve this problem today, you might F5 the application and find a bug, and then, you know, you go back and you set a breakpoint and you rerun the application and you hope that the breakpoint is somewhere around where you found the bug, and chances are it's not, so you rerun it again with a different breakpoint, but you set the breakpoint way up here, so you have to press F10 and sit there and, you know, step through the code, and it takes a long, long time. You're basically playing this ping pong going back and forth with the breakpoints. And so wouldn't it be nice if we could actually kind of help you put your thumb in the page and go back and see exactly what was happening within your application? And so that's the new capability called IntelliTrace, which we use to help do that. And so to demonstrate IntelliTrace, let's just open up my solution again. And if I open up Tools and Options, there's a new node in Options called IntelliTrace. IntelliTrace is so important, it's the only new capability that we got a trademark for, so pretty fancy. But don't have to take my word for it. We'll show you how this works. So with IntelliTrace turned on, we'll actually rewrite the MSIL for your application, and then we'll insert spots along the way that we can use to actually track events and actually track method calls if you turn that on as well. And so if we look at IntelliTrace events, we can actually log when a variety of things that might be interesting happen to your application. So, you know, maybe when we make a call to ADO.net, that's interesting, or ASP.net, or maybe when we read from a file or write to a file or read from the registry or write to the registry. You can also create your own events as well. So we expect this list to grow over time as people from the community add additional events that might be interesting. So maybe there's special events that you want to track from an Azure perspective as you start to build applications in the cloud. That might be one example. So I'll just take this list of events in here. You can just run with events only, or you can run with events and call information. So with events only, we're going to have a slight overhead hit to the application. And then with events and call information, we'll have a much greater overhead because we're actually logging all the variables that get passed or all the values that get passed into an individual method call to give you much richer information. So let me show you how you might use the two different types of IntelliTrace. So if I F5 my application now, it's going to start up. Now, I did mention there is going to be a performance overhead here because remember, we are rewriting the MSIL. So just depending on how big my application is and what it's calling and, you know, is it using any .NET Framework libraries, like we're going through here and actually reauthoring the MSIL on the fly. So it's not something you necessarily want to run with all the time, certainly not within the verbose setting, because it will have that overhead hit. But you might find a bug, and you might say, okay, let me go reproduce that bug again with IntelliTrace turned on at the verbose level. So we have my web application, and you know, let's say I'm just clicking through here, and I click down here on About Us, and About Us actually crashes. So we're experiencing a mechanical error. That's our custom error page. So that doesn't really help me, but let's go back into Visual Studio and we'll actually break. And over on the right-hand side here, you can see IntelliTrace events that are being captured. So you can see there's a bunch of ASP.NET events that are being captured. It's getting particular files. If we scroll up through these events, eventually we'll come to a bunch of exceptions. You can see some information about the exceptions. You know, a lot of the time you're lucky if an exception gets thrown and you can get some information about it because a lot of the more advanced frameworks like WPF and ASP.NET, they'll do a lot of work behind the scenes to actually catch those exceptions when they think that it's going to be preferential to crashing your application. And so it can become difficult to see exactly which exceptions are going on within your code, but here you can see all those exceptions that are being thrown and caught. If I scroll up a little bit further, we can see here that there's this XML file that's being loaded. And so this kind of gives me a clue about something that may be causing an application problem. If I look at the next exception here, you can see that we had a parsing error within that XML. So this gives me some clues about where the problem might be happening because this might relate to the problem that we just experienced. And so if I stop debugging and open up that XML file, we can see, sure enough, there's some malformed XML in here. So I happen to know that if I remove this, save the file, then that'll actually fix the XML file. Let's see if that actually fixes the problem we found here. And sure enough, that's resolved. So now let's take a look at an example of where the advanced verbose information might come into play. So let's rerun this application. See, I'm getting a warning saying that there's basically a lot of overhead in there, and that edit and continue won't work. That's fine. So we'll F5 the application again. Does it work for all browsers? Yeah, that's a great question. So at this point, we're not actually doing anything with respect to the browser. So if I wanted to, I could load this up within Firefox, within Chrome. The actual instrumentation that's taking place is the ASP.NET libraries that we've written or the ASP.NET code that we've checked in. So at this point, we're actually not even testing you know, any of the JavaScript or anything that's related to the browser. Great question. So he noticed that there's some CSS in there and wondering if that actually gets captured as part of IntelliTrace. And the answer is that no, it does not. IntelliTrace today works only against your managed code. So native code is going to be something that we're looking at for the future, but in this release it's managed code. It's a lot easier for us to do because, you know, we're running all the IL within the context of the CLR, so it's much easier for us to hook that and understand which events are taking place. So let's take a look at paper airplanes here, and we'll just add this Contoso Cloud Explorer to my shopping cart. That's great, $50, that seems like a great steal. In fact, my nephew's birthday is next week, so let's add another one for him. We'll add that to our cart again. What you notice here is that even though we clicked on add twice, it didn't actually add that item to our cart. So we've got a problem with our shopping cart functionality. So let's take a look at that IntelliTrace file and see if it will give us any more clues about what's going on. So we'll break into that. You can see that I have a lot of information going on here. We have various gets that are taking place. It would be nice if I could filter this. So I happen to know that the problem happened right after a post. So I'll filter by post, and you can see that I have two events in here. Here's an ASP.NET post. What I can do is I can now drill into the calls view. And so let's take a look at that. Now keep in mind, this is all historical. So we're not actually running the application now and stepping through your debugger like you might when you press F10 and you have a non-IntelliTrace, sort of a live debugging view. I could switch back to a live debugging view if I wanted to, but in this case, I'm kind of acting as a forensic scientist to go back and understand how did we get into this place. So I'm using my thumb to go back and see which page actually got us to this position. And so if we drill into some of this logic that's taking place. Somewhere in here we have an add item. Where's add item? Here's add item. And this is an ASP.NET MVC application. So we go through several layers of indirection, if you will, before we actually do any of the real work. So I can keep drilling down into the various components that end up calling their own add items. And eventually I get down to the bottom of the tree, and I have this add item taking place. And that actually takes me straight to the source code that's going on in the file. Now let me pause right here and tell you where these IntelliTrace files could come from. What I'm doing right here is I'm F5-ing my application and running straight within Visual Studio. So I have the latest source control that's loaded. I could also generate these IntelliTrace files from automated test runs. So for example, I have a unit test that runs overnight or even an integration test that runs overnight and I find a bug. Well, we can automatically save out that IntelliTrace file and create a bug and attach that IntelliTrace file to the bug so that when the developer gets in the morning, they open that up and they have the IntelliTrace file that they can step through. Or I can have that be captured from my manual test runs as well. So a manual tester is going through, and as you'll see later, we have an execution environment that allows them to go through and execute those test cases, and they happen to find a bug, but they have IntelliTrace turned on, so when they file that bug back to the developer, we can see that IntelliTrace event and do the same kind of reverse engineering. And so what we allow you to do here is also, as long as you're storing all of your symbols along with your builds, then we allow you to attach to the source code that was relevant for that particular build. So if a tester finds a bug in last Wednesday's build, and you are obviously working on today's build, when you open up that IntelliTrace file, we can connect back to Team Foundation Server and pull the source code and step through the source control as it was loaded on Wednesday. So what you see here, might correspond to last Wednesday's build that you're looking at. So in any event, looking back at this source code, we can see that we have this add item method that's being called. And if I F10, we can actually step right into this. Remember, this is all historical information, so I'm stepping through and seeing exactly what happened within my call stack. And here you can see adjust quantity. And so adjust quantity, I might happen to know this is where we're actually changing the shopping cart quantity within my shopping cart. And if we expand the locals window, you can see the values that were actually passed into that particular method. So we have this item.quantity, which was passed in, and so new quantity is being set to 1. And so obviously that might have a clue about what the problem is that's going on. And so if we break right now, you can see that item.quantity is the existing quantity, but we're forgetting to pass in the new quantity that we're wanting to add. So if I come in here, say plus quantity, if I rerun this application, then that should fix our bug. So with IntelliTrace running just on the events only, what we wouldn't have gotten is we wouldn't have gotten the information that says exactly which values were being passed into the method historically. All we would have seen is that we have these various events that are taking place. But if you want to know exactly which data is being passed in and out of methods, then the IntelliTrace in the verbose setting is the nice way to do that. So if I come back to paper airplanes, it looks like I already have one item in my cart because this is persistent storage. Come on. Did I mention there's an overhead hit? And I'm running in a virtual machine. Okay, there we go. So now if we add that item back to our cart, quantity goes up to 2. So just a couple of examples of how IntelliTrace can help you out. And let's go ahead and remove that for the next demonstration. So that concludes our sort of lap around application lifecycle management. Now what I'm going to do is spend the rest of our time together talking specifically about software testing. Yes. That is always the next question that I get when I show this. So can you use this to capture a bug within a production environment? And that is the goal. We want to enable that scenario. However, right now, we don't advocate that just because of the performance overhead. So in the next release, we're doing a lot of work to improve the performance of IntelliTrace and add some additional capabilities so that you could hook this up to a production system, maybe even have this running it. You might imagine running it at your customer site. So your customer is running IntelliTrace in the background. They call you at 3 a.m. in the morning and you say, I'm going back to sleep, but send me the IntelliTrace file. And then Monday morning, you've got everything you need to see exactly what's going on. So yes, absolutely great question. That's the direction we're going with this. Right now, we only advocate it for development and test environments. Yeah. Could that be done on a session base? So you're talking about like an ASP.NET session? So you could run it on a production web server without impacting the rest of your production traffic. Is that the idea? So no, currently you wouldn't want to do that because remember what we do when we turn on IntelliTrace is we actually reauthor that MSIL, and so you'd run into some problems if you had a production web server that was running and handling production system requests, and then you attached the debugging process and you tried to reauthor that MSIL. It would probably slow down. I haven't tried it, but it would probably slow down the rest of your production requests that are coming in. So it's not something I would recommend. But that sounds like a good problem we'll have to solve once we enable the sort of Dev 11. Future for this feature. So right now, you should just take that production environment, clone that within your test environment, and then run it with that turned on. But yeah, that's a great question and a good concern. So this is the point in the presentation where I tell you about why software testing is important. You're all here today, so I know that you already know all of this. It's just some interesting data. This is, of course, U.S. data, but U.S. software economy or U.S. economy spends about $60 billion, every year on software defects. I actually think that seems kind of low to me, but that's still an awful lot of money. On average, professional coders make 100 to 150 errors for every 1,000 lines of code they write. That's kind of scary. We've got to catch that information and make sure that we're fixing these problems. But those are some of the top coders in the world make those number of mistakes. So we need to be able to catch these. If you take a look at some of the more famous examples of problems that have come up, these are a few of my favorites. So this is the USS Yorktown. They deemed it a smart ship because they put a bunch of Pentium 200 computers on the ship and had those take over some systems like navigation and other important systems on the ship. I personally think I'd be a little bit afraid of trying to beta my software out on a ship and then have the commander say, all right, this is our smart ship, because there's going to be a problem then and everyone's going to make fun of you for history. But that's sure enough what happened. Someone entered a zero into one of the text boxes and it caused it to divide by zero and shut down the entire ship. So, kind of embarrassing, right? I had to pick on Europe, of course. So this is a European space program, Ariane 5. Sounds like you guys are already familiar with this one. So we had an overflow and a value. If you have a value that goes very, 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 very big, and then you add 1, it might loop around to be a very, very, very big negative number. Well, spaceships, they like to go up, and so if you loop that value around and then it becomes negative, then that's usually not a good thing. The cost of this one, $370 million U.S. dollars in 1996 prices. So that's a lot more money today, of course. If you like this kind of stuff, there's this fascinating presentation that was delivered at OSCON a few years ago called The History of Failure. And in The History of Failure, he shows a bunch of these examples, but he also calculates the net worth of a human life. And so he takes the GDP for a country and he divides the number of people and he multiplies by the average life expectancy. And he comes up with some value like $3.2 million is the average net worth of an individual. And then he concludes that it's possible to eradicate the value of your life and the value of tens or hundreds of thousands or thousands of other lives by making one simple problem with software. And so my goal for today is to make sure that none of us in this room show up in a future history of failure presentation. Likewise, you know, the F-22 Raptor, this was actually a happy ending because in the end, when they crashed over the international dateline and the computer shut down, they were able to follow clear weather all the way back to Hawaii, and you know, it was a happy ending. But you can imagine this could have resulted in a loss of a very, very expensive plane. And of course, you know, I work for Microsoft, so I live in a glass house. So if I'm going to talk about other people's problems, we can talk about some of our own. I'm not sure I want to shut that down. That seems kind of important. That's Visual C# 2005 Express Edition setup. This file is still copying. I love this one. An error has occurred while displaying the error that has occurred while creating an error report. Like, really? Okay. And, you know, what can you say to this but just okay? Like, thanks, SQL Server. So, you know, those are interesting, but what do we do about it? And, you know, I for fun, I climb mountains and do rock climbing and all this stuff. And I like to think about our philosophy to software testing and software quality along the same lines that I think about getting ready for a mountain climb. And so in the beginning, you know, you're in the gym and you're spending a lot of time working on conditioning, trying out your gear, working on your technique. And if you know, maybe you hurt your finger, like I jammed my finger the other day, you know, the cost of failure at that point is not very high. You might take a couple days off, and then you're back in the gym. It's not the end of the world. But when you get out onto the mountain and you've just summited a, you know, 9,500-foot peak, and you look behind you, and I don't know if you can see that, but that's very dark weather behind us. And about 20 minutes after this photo was taken, we got hit by, I guess, be like a 75-kilometer-an-hour hailstorm that we were not ready for. And so at that point, you're really hoping that you've ironed out all the bugs from your system. You know, you understand how to use your gear's well-tested, you understand first aid, you've got a good support network back home that you can call in case there's a problem. And the cost of failure at this point is very, very high. You know, you might lose a limb or die or anything like that, right? And so if you look at the software development lifecycle, it's very similar in this regard. So if you're a developer and you're sitting at your desk and you know, you hit F5 and you found a problem like I just did, it might take 20 minutes of your time to fix it. It's not a very high cost. You're in the presence of mind to fix it right then and there, and no one else had to be disturbed by the fact that you just coded up a bug. But if you ship that same bug to your customer and it ends up shutting down a, you know, an aircraft carrier, or God forbid, ends up killing somebody because you're dealing with medical software or something along those lines, you can imagine that this bug is going to be incrementally more expensive. And so I've seen data that shows that a bug that is found in production can cost between 10 and 100 times more than if that same bug was caught within the development and testing lifecycle. And so of course, we want to try to drive that quality upstream whenever we can. So we want to help give developers tools to catch their own bugs and to fix those bugs. And if we don't catch it within the development lifecycle, then at least let's make sure that we catch it when it goes off to the testers and help make sure that that bug never actually ships its way to a customer. And so when we started to take a look at how we could address this problem, what Microsoft could do to try and improve software quality across the board, one of the first things we did was we looked at the landscape of software testing, which happens across the industry. And so at the far end of the spectrum, we have sort of specialized testing. These are developers who are usually writing code. Think of it as unit tests or specialized testing frameworks, mocking frameworks, what have you, writing code that tests other code. And then at the far end of the spectrum on this side, we have manual testers. So these are testers that come in every morning. They have a set of scripts that might be, you know, Word documents or Excel spreadsheets, and they very laboriously run through and manually test the application. And, you know, I went to school and, you know, learned how to do specialized testing and all this stuff, and I just assumed that the majority of testing that took place today, you know, 2010, probably was on the right end of the spectrum. But when we started looking at customers, big and small, we found that actually 70% of the testing that takes place across, you know, pretty much any organization you look at, 70% of that testing is still manual testing. And if you stop and think about it, it does make sense, because manual tests are cheap to write and they're cheap to maintain, and they might be more expensive to execute. But if you have an automated test that you've spent a lot of time and money investing in, and you go and you change the application, and the application now causes all these tests to fail, then that automated test is useless. Whereas with a manual tester can say, okay, we changed the way this login routine works, so instead of testing it this way, I'm going to test it this way. Manual tester also doesn't need to have any special validation logic, because they can see the bugs and they can surface those back to the development team and let them know what's going on. Whereas with an automated test, you have to invest in writing that assertion logic. And so I think that for quite some time, maybe even forever, we'll continue to have manual testing taking up the lion's share of software testing across most development teams. But the problem is that the majority of the tools that are out there, most vendors and most open source projects, are delivering functionality that's targeted at testers on the right end of the spectrum, or more specifically, developers who are writing code which is then testing the application. And so these manual testers are kind of left in the Stone Age, where they're continuing to use, you know, Word documents or Excel spreadsheets, if they're lucky, to manage, to organize, to run all these tests. And so in this release, we really wanted to spend a lot of work targeting the manual tester. So when I say that we're going to be talking about software testing with Visual Studio 2010 today, I'm actually not focusing on capabilities we've shipped in the past, like unit testing or mocking frameworks that work with Visual Studio or web or load testing. Instead, I'm going to be focusing on manual testing. And so, you know, you guys, someone over here already mentioned this earlier. What happens when a developer gets a bug from a tester, and that bug report comes back? You know, developer looks at that and says, well, you know, you must not be doing something right, because it works on my machine, right? I mean, we're all guilty of this. This happens all the code. We're very proud developers. We don't write code problems. You know, that 150 lines of code per 1,000, that's somebody else, right? That's not me that's coding up those mistakes, right? But let's say that, you know, we put our pride aside and we say, okay, once in a while, you know, maybe every few months I might make one mistake, right? And so, you know, Martin comes to me and he says, all right, here's a problem that I found in your code. And I look at Martin and I say, well, it does work on my machine, so you must be doing something differently. And we have this long, drawn-out conversation about, well, what kind of machine are you running? Are you running the latest service pack? Do you have, you know, are you running even last night's build? Because I'm pretty sure I fixed a similar problem last week. You know, are you running IE versus Firefox? You know, all this information that we now have to exchange to go back and forth and try and figure out how I was able to reproduce that bug, or how he was able to reproduce that bug, and I'm not. And so the knee-jerk reaction that I see in a lot of teams is to say, okay, anytime a tester finds a bug, we want to have them fill out these 10 pages that say the title of the bug, the description, you know, what operating system, all this information, right? And so now the next time Martin comes to me with a bug, he might look at a bug and say, well, is it really that important? Do I really, you know, need to go through those 10 pages, or are the customers going to kind of understand that we have a couple bugs here and there? And so that's not a situation you want to find yourselves in either. It's making the testers less productive, and it's also encouraging bad behavior where they may not be filing bugs that they would have otherwise filed. So these are some of the problems that we're trying to address, and some of the philosophy around how we're going to address those. So let's spend the rest of the time showing exactly how we've done that in 2010. This is a presentation I put together which shows various workflows, both the tester, the developer, the rest of the team, as well as the lab management workflow we'll talk about later on. I could spend 4 hours talking about this diagram, but we don't have that kind of time. So if some of this looks interesting and we don't get to everything within here, you can download this off of my blog and you can explore this on your own. The other thing that you'll notice down here is that there are videos in line here as well. So for example, when we talk about defining a test plan, I'm going to show you how to do that here. But if you want to go back and see how that's done within the product at your own leisure, or show other people on your team, you can point them at my blog and they can go through that at their own pace. So so as a tester, one of the first things that I'll do is I'll come into the product and I'll define a test plan. And I know Clemens is going to be talking a lot about Sajeti's philosophy around test plans, and so some of this is going to line up with what he's talking about, but he'll also talk about test plans in sort of a broader sense as well. But when I talk about test plans, I'm talking about a test plan within the tool I'm about to show you, called Microsoft Test Manager. And the idea with a test plan is that you want to capture things like, okay, what are we actually testing? novel concept, right? Development team's building something. We need to make sure that our test plan corresponds with what they're building. So if we're adding, security features to the site, maybe we want to make sure we test those security features. We also need to capture things like what configurations are we going to support. So maybe the marketing team is promoting a product that we sell which works on Windows 2000 and Windows Server 2003. So we need to make sure that we test both of those operating systems in conjunction with our software. And then we also need to capture which information we want to collect and feedback to the developers as well. So I mentioned, system information. I mentioned, 32-bit versus 64-bit. Wouldn't it be nice to have a video recording of the test being executed so that when Martin comes to me with a problem, I can open up the video and we eliminate this back and forth confusion about, did I actually run everything correctly the way that the software was intended to behave? Or maybe I'm doing something a little bit different than the way Martin's doing, and then we can have that discussion. So we can start to capture automatically a lot of this information and then relay it back to the developers so when they open that up, they've got everything at their fingertips in order to solve the problem and understand exactly what's going on. IntelliTrace, I already mentioned, you can also capture the IntelliTrace files and attach those to the bugs as well. And then finally, test configuration. So how do we model exactly what we're going to be testing our software in different, how we're going to test that in different environments. And so to show you what this looks like, let's launch the new product we have called Microsoft Test Manager. And Microsoft Test Manager is a tool that we've built specifically for software testers. So this was built from the ground up in WPF. It's part of the Visual Studio 2010 family, but we didn't want to have to tell testers, okay, welcome to this brave new world of software testing. Go learn Visual Studio, install this 4-gig package, and good luck. We wanted to build a tool that was really targeted at the way that software testing teams think and operate. And so what you can see here is that we have two different what are called activity centers, and this breaks down into the testing center, which is where you'll probably spend most of your time, and then the lab center as well, which is where I'll be showing you the way that our virtual environments can be configured as well. So from the testing center, we have these activities across the top: plan, test, track, and organize. Plan, obviously, this is where we put together our individual test requirements and all of our test cases, which then map to those requirements. We can also come in to test, which is where a tester will come in the morning and see which tests they need to run. And so if we come back to plan and go to properties, we can start to define some metadata about this plan. So we have, this corresponds to iteration 2. For this particular iteration, we're focusing on site fit and finish work. So this is based on the outcome of a meeting between the test lead and the development lead to say, okay, what are you guys building? All right, this is what we're going to test. And you can see this maps to an iteration within TFS. None of this metadata actually matters at the end of the day. I could write whatever I want, but this is just really to help the team understand what it is that we're testing. What does matter is the test settings, the test configuration, the environments, and everything else on the lower half of the window. So test settings is where you get to define exactly which data you're going to capture. Let me actually just create a new test setting. And so we'll call this Copenhagen. Roles is where you define which machines you're going to be capturing information from. I'm doing everything on my local machine up here, but if you had a three-tier system that you're testing, and maybe you have a data tier and a web tier and a client tier, it might be interesting to capture a video recording of what the tester is doing on the client tier. Then on the middle tier, you want to capture IntelliTrace information because that's where your ASP.NET code is executing. And then on the data tier, you want to capture an event log. And so you might want to define different test settings at each system along the way. And then what you can do is install agents on each one of those machines, which automatically capture the information that you specify here. Whoops. Data and diagnostics, this is where you configure each tier within the system and say exactly what you're capturing. So actions we'll come back to. IntelliTrace, we've already talked about. Test impact is something I'll talk about later. Event log, quite plainly, I want to capture the event log, and I want to capture these particular events. And so anything that happens from the time I start my test to the time I finish my test, which shows up within the event log, fitting these characteristics, will be logged for me automatically. Maybe I also want to capture a video recording, just turn that on. System information, I'll show you where that surfaces, but this is what operating system with service pack level, how much RAM do I have on my system. And these don't have to collect data either. Another type of data diagnostic adapter is the network emulation. So network emulation actually allows you to impact a machine that that's part of your test environment. So if I click on network emulation and go to configure, we allow you to say, this particular machine, maybe your database server, we want to pretend like this is over a wide area network, and so we're going to simulate a 128K link for that particular machine. And so you can have these data diagnostic adapters impact the machine under test. And you can even write your own as well. So maybe there's a file that's really important for your diagnostics, and you want to collect that every time a bug is found. You can write your own data diagnostic adapter. We've got documentation in the MSDN library which describes how to do that. Or maybe you want to... when you run your tests, you want to see what happens if we fill up the hard drive before you run those tests. And so you can have a data diagnostic adapter which does that, fills up the hard drive, and then you run your tests. And so you're actually impacting the machine under test. And so you can do those by creating your own custom data diagnostic adapters. But what I have here is I have two different test settings files that I've created. One is full diagnostics and one is lightweight diagnostics. The reason I've done this is that I might want to quickly run through some of my tests by having lightweight diagnostics. And as you saw earlier, IntelliTrace can have an overhead performance impact on your systems that you're running. And so I might not want to run with that turned on all the time. But let's say I do find a bug, I might want to go back and run with full diagnostics turned on so that I make sure that the developer has everything they need in order to actually understand what's going on within that system. Builds we'll talk about later on, but this is basically just linking back to Team Foundation build. This is configuration, so I can decide what configurations I'm going to test with. I've got operating systems that I might want to test with, browsers. You can even define your own third-party library. So I need to make sure my software runs with version 2 and version 3 of a particular library. So we can represent that in here and make sure we run my tests, two or more times in order to accommodate these different configurations. So once I define my variables, I can then create combinations and say I'm going to test everything with Vista and IE7 or Windows Server and IE8. So you can set up your different configurations and that will impact the number of times that you run each test. So now we've created our test plan, and now the idea is that we want to start adding the individual tests that we're going to create to that test plan. And so we give you a couple different capacities to organize your tests, which I'll drop into as well. And then we give you the ability to start writing those manual tests as well. So this goes beyond just a simple Excel spreadsheet or Word document. One of the things you can do with this is you can actually create what are called shared steps. And so if you think of the problem today with a Word document where you've got 100 different test cases, and every one of them starts with, go to this page and type your username and type password and click sign in and yada, yada, yada. And now you've actually changed the way that login works. Well, now you've got to go back and update those 100 Word documents or Excel spreadsheets. With shared steps, what we allow you to do is define something that may get used across multiple test cases and then gets referenced again and again. And if you make changes to that particular sign-in logic, so maybe instead of just username and password, you also need to type in a CAPTCHA response, then you can allow that to be changed in one location, and then that cascades across all the other examples of test cases which use that. So let's write our first test case. So over on the plan activity under content, we can start to see the way that we organize our test cases. So we have three requirements-based test suites. And so you can see requirements 7, 8, 9. These are actually coming out of Team Foundation Server, so these might be user stories. You might want to call them value propositions or requirements. We don't care what you call them, but basically these are what you would then map test cases back to. And so you can see I have test cases for requirement number 7. If I open up this requirement, this is a work item within Team Foundation Server, and likewise, we actually store the individual test cases as work items as well. So this is a work item within TFS as well, and those have that that bidirectional tested by relationship that we talked about earlier. We could also create a query-based test suite. So maybe I'm not adding new functionality to this application, but there was some new functionality that I added in the first iteration that was really high priority that we needed to make sure that continued to work. So I could pull in all the high priority test cases from that first iteration just by creating a query which specified that I want to grab all the high priority test cases from iteration one. I can also create a static test case or static test suite and just add test cases straight to it. So that's what we'll do here. Let's add a new test case. And once again, I'll spare you my typing skills. So there's our title. So for this particular test case, we're going to be making, we're going to be validating that a receipt actually appears when we check out an item from our e-commerce store. And so normally I'd come in here and just start typing the individual actions that we want the tester to perform. Here I've just pasted a big list here. So you can see I want the tester to open up this website. They should click on Model Airplanes, click on Northwind Trader. But there's a few things that are making this a little bit more unique than just a list of steps. And the first one of those is this list of test parameter values, or test parameters rather. And so if you have a test that maybe you want to make sure gets tested with really big positive numbers and really big negative numbers as well, instead of having to create that test case multiple times, you can parameterize that test case. And so in this case, I've created a first name, a last name, and an email address parameter just by using the ampersand symbol to create that value. And so what you can see is that each one of those values up there actually corresponds to a column in my parameter values grid down below. And so now if we come into the values that I've created in advance, we can paste those. And what that's telling the test case is that we need to run that test case once for each row of data that exists within that particular test case. There's another special attribution up here, which is an expected result. And so an expected result is a spot where we're telling the manual tester, you need to tell us whether or not this particular test step is passing or failing. And so you may say, you know, at this point, you've done a bunch of stuff, you've clicked on stuff, you've typed some stuff into the application, but we need to, at this point, pause and make sure that a receipt does actually appear on the screen. And so the tester has an option. They can actually say pass or fail for each individual test step if they want to, but if we want to require that for this particular test step, you absolutely have to tell us whether or not a step passes or fails, this is a good way of doing that. Another thing I could do if I wanted to is I could insert an attachment here on an individual test step. So maybe I wanted to show the tester what success looks like if we actually do see a receipt. I could attach a screenshot of what that receipt is supposed to look like, and they could open that while they're executing the test so they could see what they should be reporting against. So we'll go ahead and save that test case, and now that shows up as test case number 48. And then we'll put on my tester hat and come to the list of test cases that I'm supposed to execute. So I go to my test activity. And on the test activity, we see the same view over here, only you may notice that we're missing one of those requirements-based test suites. And so we have 7 and 8. What happened to 9? Well, if you go back to the plan tab, you'll notice that number 9 actually has a different icon. And that indicates that that particular requirements-based test suite is in planning. So we might be at a point where we're still writing those test cases. And so you can change the state of that to in planning, which signals to the test team that they don't need to actually run these tests yet. Likewise, maybe you get to a point where you have a pretty high confidence that a particular suite is passing, you know, helping about, it's working great. So you set that to completed. That'll no longer show up on their dashboard of what they need to test. But if I come back to test and I look at end-to-end tests, we see I have test case number 48. So let's go ahead and run that test case. I'm just going to close down my other applications first, just to clean up my system a bit. I'll run this test case, and this is going to launch the Microsoft Test Runner. And so Test Runner very simply gives the tester a list of test steps that they need to perform. It asks them to interact with the Test Runner to say whether or not a test step is passing or failing. This is where they can create bugs. But it also has a unique property in that this can actually record all of my interactions with the application I'm testing. And so what I can do is I can create an action recording here and start my test. Okay. And now from this point forward, we're going to capture all the actions that I perform as I interact with my application under test. And so it says here I need to launch this web application, so let's copy that URL. Launch Internet Explorer. paste that URL. Now, what I actually did is I copied something from this pane. I went over to the address bar, or first I launched Internet Explorer, then I went over to the address bar, and I pasted that URL into the application. And so behind the scenes, it was capturing all those actions. But what you can see down here at the bottom is it actually collapsed that into just two actions. One is I started testing, and then I opened up this particular web page. And so whenever we can, we'll be smart about trying to collapse multiple actions which might be redundant into actually the origin of intent. What did the tester mean when they captured that or when they performed that action? And the reason we do that is that it makes playback later on easier. So you'll see me actually playback these actions later on, and eventually we'll fully automate these actions into what's called a coded UI test. And so by doing this, it allows us to collapse these actions so that they're more robust later on when we're playing them back. Because imagine a scenario where maybe I didn't have Internet Explorer in the taskbar down there, and so we don't want this to break if we move it to another machine and we don't actually have the IE icon down there. Instead, we know that we want to launch Internet Explorer, so we just do that. Question? The URL might, I'm not sure I followed everything. So can you do that one more time? I see. Okay. So I think I'm going to address your question in a moment when you show how we deal with parameter values. So so maybe pause for a second and let me know later on if I didn't address your question. So that is a good one. So at this point, what I'm going to do is say that particular test step passed. And then it's telling me to go ahead and click on Model Airplanes. And we'll pass that. Click on Northwind Trader. Pass that. Now, I mentioned earlier that you don't actually have to say pass-fail for every step. However, it's a good idea to do that when you're capturing action recordings. The reason is that your action recordings can then be related back to those individual test steps. And later on, if I wanted to play back maybe 5 out of 10 of those action recordings, I could select just those 5 steps and play those back. And it understands the difference between the various steps that I'm performing. Add to cart. Check out. And this is where it gets interesting, and this is where I think I'm going to address his question. So now we've got the various parameter values that we need to enter for this particular iteration. So remember, I had 3 different rows, different parameter values. For this particular one, we're going to be filling out customer information for our friend Michael Affronti. And so here we have first name, and this is really easy. So what I can do is just select the text box, control paste. Control paste, control paste. Pretty cool, huh? City, I think. Home sweet home, Redmond. We do have to select something, even though it's the same, because that's what's going to trigger the data binding to happen. And so for those of you in the front row, what you'll notice here is that we have these yellow icons that are showing up alongside each one of my parameter values. Oh, he wanted me to use the laser pointer. Yellow icons. Fancy. Thanks. What that's doing is it's actually indicating that we've data bound, for example, Michael, the first name column, with this particular text box. And so now when we play this back later, it's going to know where to put those values. Likewise, if we needed to get a value twice, like maybe we had a password and a confirmed password, all I would need to do is come back to my list of parameter values, click on that, it would copy that into my clipboard again, paste it, and you would actually see 2 data binding icons to indicate that we know that that value goes into 2 different text boxes or other cells that you might have on your form. Now we need to select Washington. And then postal code. Okay, review order, almost done. Okay, here's our validation step. So it's telling us we should make sure that the receipt number appears on this page. And sure enough, there's our receipt number. So we'll pass this. And then finally, we'll just close the browser. So now we've done the hard work. We've run through our first iteration, and we've captured the action recording. Now let's take advantage of that work. So if I end that iteration and go to the next iteration, you'll see it here at the top that we're now on iteration 2 of 3. So we're on that second row of data within my test case. So now if I start my test case, I can select, let's go all the way down to here, click on play. My hands are off. So now it's going to go through and it's going to play back all those actions that I recorded. So by default, we're going to go as fast as we can. We're going to look for the controls as they render, and we're going to go ahead and click on those controls. If I wanted to, I could also honor the recording speed that I used during the first time that I recorded this. So maybe you want to actually play this back, the same speed that you expect a user to interact with your application. You can flip a setting to enable that as well if you want. So here now it's handing control back to the tester. So I just fast-forwarded through those first 9 steps because those are really boring. I hate doing that stuff. But I'm a tester, so I'm now going to use my brain, look at the application, and make sure that everything's performing correctly. There's a receipt. We'll go ahead and pass that. And then just for grins, I'll go ahead and play that last step, which is to close the browser. So now I end that test iteration, do the same thing, and play it back. And so the next question I always get at this point is, well, which applications does this work with? Clearly, it's not going to work with every type of application because we have to understand from an accessibility perspective how you're interacting with that application. I have another slide I'll show here in a little bit which shows the applications that we'll support with the RTM of the product. That includes Windows applications, Windows Forms applications, WPF applications, web applications, obviously. We've even shipped an additional extensibility pack for supporting playback in Firefox. So if I wanted to, I could record all these steps within Internet Explorer and then play them back in Firefox because something may render differently in Firefox than in IE, and that's important for us to be able to surface. So everything that we've done within this testing framework is extensible. We're actually building support for Silverlight later on as well, and we're working with partners and third-party control vendors to provide support to automate their controls as well. So we'll just finish off this test case, pass that, close the browser. So at this point, if I had a bug, I could come into my tool here and create a new bug that would automatically take all of those attachments that I had collected from my test settings. So maybe that's an event log, maybe that's a video, maybe that's an IntelliTrace file. Automatically capture all that data and push it back to Team Foundation server as part of the bug. The other thing I could do is I could, for example, capture a screenshot. So maybe it's important for me to take a screenshot that shows, this part of the application is not working correctly. Actually, that was the wrong one. Rectangular. So, I don't like the way the recycle bin's rendering, whatever. And then I could file a bug from there. So let's go ahead and end that iteration and then show you what that looks like when a developer opens up that bug. So we'll save that. And I have a bug that I created earlier. So if I come back into track and we look at my bugs, this would look identical if you were looking at it within Visual Studio. I just happen to be showing it within Microsoft Test Manager. So, pretend you're a developer if you want. You open up this bug. And now, instead of what used to happen in the past where, you'd be lucky just to receive this, like, hey, there's a one-line description showing me what this bug is, now we get a lot of rich information. So here what we can see is this is the test case that the tester was running when they ran and encountered this bug. And by the way, here's the step that it failed on according to the tester. And if I don't want to take their word for it, I can actually click on a video link as well. And that video link is indexed based on when in the timeline they encountered that bug. So if they encountered that bug on step 5, we're able to determine that at step 5, they were actually 35 seconds into the execution of the test case. So when we open up that video file, we're going to take you straight to that section of the video as opposed to you having to sit down and watch some 5-minute video file to figure out where the tester had a problem. We also automatically capture things like system information. So here's the system information I promised you earlier. So here's machine name. I'm running NT Service Pack 2. Actually, that's not NT. That's Windows Server. If I have, amount of RAM I've got. So lots of rich information. So Martin and I no longer have to play this ping pong back and forth of, okay, what browser were you running? What operating system? What service pack? What build? You can see build gets captured in here as well. I have all the information I need at my fingertips as a developer to understand what's going on. Likewise, if I went to details, I've got an IntelliTrace file down here. I can open that up and go through the similar scenario that I showed you in the IntelliTrace demo. So these are actionable bugs. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to get these bugs from your testers every time they found a bug? And so that's what we're trying to enable for you. How are we doing on time? 5 minutes left. Great. Perfect. So another thing that we do within our test offering is we also help the testers answer the question of not only what build should I be testing, but what's actually changed in this build as well. So think about it, you know, put your tester hat on and think about what a tester goes through when they pick up a new build. So they pick up last night's build, and now they have to go around to all the developers and say, hey, what changed, or did you fix that bug? You know, if they're lucky, they can look through Team Foundation Server or Bugzilla or whatever work item tracking system you have and try to discern some of this information. But wouldn't it be nice if we surfaced some of this information for them to help answer those questions? And so part of the experience with Microsoft Test Manager is to help take that information and compile it and put it together in one easy-to-consume dashboard that helps them not only pick the build, but then figure out what the impact of that build is on the test cases that they now need to go back and rerun. And so if I come back to my virtual machine, we'll see under the Track tab, we can assign a build. And let me just go back to that build. So by default, right now, we're testing everything against this build number 318.3. And so 318.3 might be, let's say, last Wednesday's build. And so now I have the choice as a tester to say, okay, should we continue testing against last Wednesday's build, or maybe we want to pick up a newer build? And picking up a newer build has a certain cost associated with it. We have to go deploy that build. We need to tell the rest of our test team to stop using the old build and start using the new build. So I need to now answer the question of whether or not it's worth me picking up the new build. And so usually a development team will have someone that scouts the build, makes sure the build meets a certain quality, it passes unit tests, it's installable, you know, that would be nice. And so once they do that, they can start to have these builds meet certain filters within team build so that we're only showing builds in here which do meet a given, you know, automated test quality. And so now I'm looking at that filtered list and I'm saying, okay, based on those builds, which one do I want to now pick up? And so we can see here that we have .4, which is the build right after that one. And then down at the bottom, we can give the tester some indication about what's changed in that build. So since .3, since the last build we picked up, .4 now introduces this change. So we've implemented a new task. We've written a regular expression for verifying strong passwords. So I say, okay, that's, you know, maybe that's not so interesting for me to completely pick up a new build, but looking at .5, all right, this is starting to get a little bit more interesting. So now, in addition to that one original task, we now have this other one, which is we've added that regular expression to the website, and that actually closes out a user story. So now I know that my test cases for that user story can now be run. Maybe previously I couldn't run them because the development team actually didn't implement this behavior. So that's good to know. And then likewise, looking at the latest build, we can see there's one more thing, which is a bug fix. So that's great. I found this bug. Martin tells me he fixed it, so now I want to verify that bug. So let's take that build, we'll assign it to the plan. This tells the rest of my testers, this is the build we're testing with. But it also tells me that some of the tests that you ran in the past may not be working anymore because of changes in the latest build. So, okay, well that makes sense, but throw me a bone here. Help me figure out exactly which test cases I might want to rerun, because I might have 100 different test cases, and they were all working against last Wednesday's build, but now, you know, Clemens has gone off and he's made changes. I don't know what he's changed, but I might need to rerun some of those tests. And so I might go sit down with him and we have a discussion and we try to come up with a list, but we actually have a new capability called Test Impact Analysis, which can help you answer that question. So if I click on View Recommended Tests, this now gives me a list of test cases which may have been impacted by changes that happened since the last build. So how do we do that? Well, for your managed code, we can run with test impact analysis enabled so that when you run a test, whether that's a manual test or an automated test, we can actually say that when you ran that test out of these five classes, we actually executed these three classes, and within each one of these classes, we executed three methods in this one, five methods in this one, and one method in this one. So that test case passed, but now Clemens has gone back and he's changed a method in this particular class. And so now what we do is we flag the original test cases which relied on that as being impacted. And so now when I pick up that new build, it now tells the tester, you know, out of those 100 test cases you have to worry about on a daily basis, we think you should spend the first part of your day actually running these 10 test cases. These are impacted by changes that happened within the source code. That doesn't mean that they're broken. Hopefully Clemens is writing good code and they didn't actually break anything, but it means you might want to go back and rerun those test cases. Likewise, it doesn't mean that those other 90 test cases weren't impacted. Maybe, you know, something changed on the back end or another dependent system or something outside of the realm of managed code which caused those to break. So eventually you might want to rerun all those test cases, but at least before lunchtime, let's see what we can do to run those top 10 test cases and let the developers know what's going on. So think of it kind of as a heat map for understanding which changes you want to which test cases you want to rerun. And so now, let's say I do want to rerun those test cases because I don't necessarily trust Clemens' code. No offense. So I'll reset those back to active. I'll go back to my test tab. And now, as a tester, when I look at what needs to be rerun, those test cases now are no longer showing up as passed. They're now back to active, meaning that I want my test team to rerun those. One last thing, then we'll break for lunch, and that is under track. If I come into queries as a developer, or as a tester, rather, and I look at bugs that I may have created in the past. I'm in the wrong place. Recommended tests, that's what I wanted. I said lunch and then I got all confused and excited. Verify bugs. So if I look at verify bugs gives me a list of all the bugs that I've previously assigned to developers that they've now allegedly fixed and assigned back to me as a tester to verify that the fix is correct. And so here you can see this is a bug that allegedly Clemens fixed, and now we need to make sure that we rerun that. So at this point I can right click and I could say verify, and I won't do it, but basically what it does is it relaunches that original test case and puts it back in the Microsoft Test Runner, and then I run through and I make sure that that test either passes or fails. If it fails, I assign it back to Clemens. If it passes, you know, everybody's happy. So we'll go ahead and break right there for, I think lunch is now, right? So we'll go ahead and break, and then we'll see you again at 1 o'clock. So, 1:15? Fantastic.